Vinny are cool as hell. He scores the ball and he rebounds well. Don't fight the future, honey. Don't fight the future. The future is Luka. The timing sucks cause the Mavs are ass. But did you see his no-look pass? Whoa! Don't fight the future, honey. Don't fight the future. The future is Luka.
Welcome to 77 Minutes, the Dallas Mavericks podcast, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. I'm Tim Cato. I talk, write, do things about the Mavericks. I've got the full cast, the normal cast, Dave Dufour, Mike Bellucci. How are you guys?
Better than this time a week ago. I was suffering from vaccine shot number two and day number two, and I was feeling about as bad as the Mavericks looked a week ago. So, but I'm here now. I feel mostly good, which I feel like is how the Mavericks mostly look after a couple wins against the Lakers before that dud last night. So, I'm here. How are you, Dave?
I'm good. I feel like I could use a game against Andre Drummond, though, because then I'd look really good.
True.
Maybe two games against Andre Drummond. You know, if I really want to look good. It's kind of a shame that it didn't happen right before the trade deadline, I think.
Yeah, wait, what was that?
Your salary going through the roof.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Great.
I see. Yeah, it was a good week for the team, all things considered. I mean, I don't know. I mean, they lost to Sacramento again with half of a team. Do either of you guys have anything to say? Because I really don't. It's the same thing we've seen.
It's the same old shit, man. Look, they play down to the competition. It feels like they don't care about games against bad teams, even though those are the ones that are going to actually get them into the playoffs. They get a slow start. And then just that's it. They're stuck in mud. And, you know, you look at the Kings game and what was it, 20-3? Is that how the game started? Something like that?
That sounds right.
Roughly. And they just couldn't ever recover. So, you know, and it doesn't help that the injury stuff is, you know, continues to be an issue, but everyone is dealing with it. De'Aaron Fox wasn't in the game.
Yeah, for that's the thing. Like, I mean, we're bringing up them not playing with, you know, with several players, but the Kings without De'Aaron Fox, I don't care.
Harrison Barnes was cooking and had to leave the game, and it didn't matter.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just don't know what else there's. I mean, they can't make any trades. There's no, you know, the buyout thing is over. I think this is just who they are, which is wildly inconsistent.
Beyond the inconsistency that comes with the defense against worse teams, and why do they make shots or why do they not make shots against worse teams? It does feel like with the Kings game, you can look at it and say, you should have lost. You should have found a way to win. You also missed a lot of shots. I mean, at this point, I'm not even saying that as a defense. It's just a weird that the trend seems to be that it's against those teams that for some reason they, you know, just kind of go through these slumps. And, you know, maybe the explanation is just that they're still a bad 3-point shooting team, all things considered. They're still bottom half of the league and they're still dead last on wide open shots in terms of percentage. Maybe that number is bumped up, but as of a few days ago, they're still dead last in the league. And that wasn't something if you just look at the past month or something, it's not like they've been any better during that period of time either. There's no trending up that's happening in terms of their shot making.
No, and meanwhile, you know, shout out to friend of the program, the great Bobby Corrala, who pointed out in the last 11 games, opponents are shooting 38.5% from three against this team. So you're not making shots. They are making shots. That is irrespective of who you are playing. Sacramento hit a bunch of threes against them last night. They can't guard the perimeter very well. They can't make shots from the perimeter. They can beat any team on any given night. They can lose to any team on any given night. That is a recipe for a slightly above average team. Probably an average team, but you have the best offensive player in the game now, so you are a slightly above average team, and that's just
it's a not quite good team that has Luka Doncic.
Pretty much, yeah. That's it. And when you factor in the you know, we were saying before the show, right, like just the way the season is going at large, not just for Dallas, but for everyone – in a sample of any three or four games, either the Mavericks are missing someone crucial or the other team is missing someone crucial. It feels like three out of those four every time. So I don't even really know what I'm taking from these regular season games. I think we know what this team is. I think we know what they're going to look like going into the playoffs. The only question is, do they escape the play-in tournament or do they not? And if they don't, you could look back on things like yesterday, because that's a game they should win.
You know, they've got the Warriors tonight, right? Like, they are actually in charge of their own destiny to a certain degree, because Portland, we all have been waiting for the regression from Portland, especially in the late game stuff. Like, they just won so many games that they shouldn't have won. And that's starting to happen now. Dame doesn't look healthy. It's really in the Mavericks' hands. They just have to beat the bad teams in front of them, like the Warriors. But, you know, Steph Curry is Steph Curry. How are they going to guard him? What is it, Dorian Finney-Smith?
No, they can't. But if there is a game that I would think they get up for, this is that game. Not necessarily because of the standings, but because it is, the Warriors still have cachet. Steph has obviously been just bananas the last month. I feel like they're going to get up for it. Certainly Luka, when he sees a big name on the schedule, and Luka brings it every night anyways, but it feels like he especially brings it when he sees someone big. I see a face from Dave right now.
I mean, look, Luka is at the point where bringing it doesn't necessarily matter. If you look at the numbers, he has gotten to the LeBron level. He can just hit the numbers.
Yeah.
Does that mean he brings it every night? I don't know about that. He certainly is going to bring it in the playoffs every night. That's not a question. I'm not worried about Luka. That's the last guy I'm worried about. Whether he brings it or not against the Sacramento Kings does not matter, because I know he's going to bring it against the Clippers in the first round of the playoffs.
I guess my answer to that, because it's a fair point, it's a key distinction I think we should make. I would say that even on the lesser nights, he brings it to enough of a level where he is very rarely, if ever, the problem. And far more often, he is the reason that they are staying in these games. So even not peak Luka is still, if they drop a game, you're not going to be pointing the finger at Luka Doncic. That's generally how I feel about the answer.
Yeah, because his floor is like third team All NBA or something.
Right. Like, so, you know,
I feel great. Here's 35-7-7.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. Like, at this point, we're debating, you know, how much to what level Luka brings.
It's why
it
we don't talk about him
on
much.
A Tuesday night. I mean this for the whole team. There's nothing left to learn about them until they get to the playoffs, until they get to the postseason. You know, barring them winning out or losing out or something dramatic like that, I find it very hard to believe that any opinion I have about this team is going to change dramatically based off anything that happens in the closing, you know, closing 3 weeks ish of the regular season.
A little over
because
two?
It's coming quick. It's coming quick.
It's like 11 or 12 games.
Because again, we watched this team last season. I wrote this after the Lakers game, trying to balance the nuance of, okay, you know, it's a high right now. There's going to be another low coming soon. I mean, this team is functionally the same team that we saw last year that should have won more games, and they could have won more games this season, and they could have beat the Clippers last season in the first round with some more health. Part of that, a big part of that, was the Clippers, and you know, the fact that they were playing fairly dysfunctionally. But and the same goes for this. They can win a playoff series. They can win in the first round, probably against any team, but certainly they have decent chances to win. You know, if they end up against Denver. Or if they end up against, what do you got, Dave?
You were saying that they're not going to change your mind about who they are, and I kind of agree with you to a certain extent.
It's just we have a much larger data.
We don't know who they are though.
We have
because we haven't seen them at full strength against anybody. Well, yes, but I also think that the data point that we got against the Clippers last year is useful because it's still talent. They didn't have chemistry, but the Clippers still had talent. And the Mavs show they could play with talent, right? They could play up against superior talent, which they were able to do.
We don't know what this team is for if it's healthy for a 7-game series. We don't know
what
if they're clicking on all cylinders,
right.
Like how high their highs are.
I think the Clippers are way better this year in numerous ways.
Oh, for sure.
So I don't know. Like, the Clippers are not the matchup that it was for them last year. And, I mean, I was confident that the Mavs could make it a 6 or 7 game series because I knew the Clippers had issues. This year, they just don't have those problems. So being the 6 seed is not all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't necessarily have a ton of confidence in what happens in that first round. I mean, yeah, because I don't like their chances against the Clippers. They haven't played Phoenix well in years, like years now. So we could sit here and say Denver, maybe, because Denver's down Jamal. But, you know, I don't know. It's, I don't think there's a ton left to learn on a macro level. I do think at this point we're looking for micro level things that might change stuff. And the biggest thing that comes to mind on that front, which we saw on Saturday, was Dwight Powell looking like Dwight Powell from 2 years ago, as, you know, as to be an understatement. And, you know, Tim and I are soccer people as well. Dave, are you a soccer person?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So there's a phrase in soccer, which it's basically cover for any time a team probably makes fewer signings or moves than they should. And they have a guy that they haven't been using, but he suddenly comes back from an injury or he comes off the end of the bench and plays well. And it's always, oh, it's like a new signing. They say that all the time. It's like a new signing after a bench.
I thought you were going to say this, a player finally comes good. Which is a
no.
That's another expression they use.
Though. We've seen Dwight Powell come good though. We know he can come good, but in this case, it felt like watching him against LA. It felt a little of that vibe because NBA, you know, NBA.com released a new fancy stat last week that Luka Doncic is the most double player in the entire NBA. Which, you know, I don't think would shock us. If you were to guess where he would fall, I think we'd probably guess in the top three or four anecdotally, regardless. But now that you are going to see more and more teams continue to do that, and especially trying to double him high, if you have Dwight Powell looking like rim runner, badass Dwight Powell again, there are a lot of ways that could open up the offense that we haven't seen a lot of this year, other than, you know, the nights where Willie Cauley-Stein looks good, which isn't something that can dependably be counted on. I guess the question for you guys is, A, how much were you buying that is something of a real jumping off point versus a one-night anomaly against Andre Drummond? Or B, if you do think some segment of this is real, does this meaningfully raise the ceiling at all in a playoff series or not so much?
I think it's pretty obvious how I feel about it, so I won't go very long here. This is kind of how guys coming back from injury, this is kind of how it works. You know, he's rounded himself into better shape. He's starting to recover. So he's going to have more games where he starts to look more normal. I do think next year, like, these are great signs for next season for him. But I wouldn't expect this to be just, okay, hey, this is now Dwight Powell that we've got for the next, you know, 10 games of the regular season and for the playoffs. I would not expect that at all. The Andre Drummond factor cannot be overstated because Andre Drummond is pretty awful. And in particular, because of the way that Luka attracts the defense, right? Like, Dwight Powell ate for the reasons that you mentioned and because it was Andre Drummond trying to cover for that. So, you know, there were multiple factors at play, but I do agree with you that, like, this is a positive sign because these are really the first two games where I thought he did kind of look like he had recovered that step to a certain degree. That second jump, which is the thing that doesn't get talked about enough with most players who are great at it, but that was the thing that really separated him as a hustle guy, was that second jump. And I thought it looked better. In the last couple of weeks, it's looked improved, but in particular against Andre Drummond, where he just looks so much better, you know, because Andre Drummond was just so bad. I just worry about putting too much stock into that.
Even if he instantly became the Dwight Powell he was, let's say, December 2018, right before the injury, you know, he's still the seventh or eighth best player on this team.
I think he's still the fourth best big.
Yeah. Yeah. Behind, so, do you have Cauley-Stein ahead of him?
I have Cauley-Stein ahead of him. Yeah. Because I think what Cauley-Stein is able. Yeah. I think what he's able to do in particular as a role man. Like, I mean, Willie Cauley-Stein has had a good season. And this is a follow-up on last year. He just fits what they do perfectly. Now, Dwight Powell at full strength, I think, is a better player. But this year, for sure, I don't know. I think Cauley-Stein's been better than Dwight Powell was the last season before he got hurt.
I would put a healthy Powell over Cauley-Stein. Cauley-Stein does more. He's a better defensive player. Way better defensively. I think that's the – if, you know, and we're debating something and that's a hypothetical and
the
B,
third and fourth
truly
picks.
Truly does not matter. You know, like this is such a,
if they're choosing between one of those two guys to start in the playoffs, there are like
things,
you know,
have gone
there are bigger problems, right? Yeah it's not
sure.
A good thing. So
so at one point one of you guys said, you know, does this raise the ceiling? I mean, does any seventh or eighth best player on a team raise a ceiling? I guess they can in a very small way. I think that it does. It is really important to have a really high level rim runner to pair with Luka when he is getting doubles thrown at him as aggressively as teams are ought to do. That's good. That's important. It, honestly, if Powell raises the ceiling at all, it's that he raises Luka's ceiling. It's that he allows him to be, you know, just more functional. There's so much more of his skill set that he can unlock if he has someone he can trust to fire the ball to. You know, nobody on the team, not Cauley Stein, nobody else catches the ball and then creates space while moving towards the rim as well as Powell does. Like that is his absolute elite skill. That's why he, you know, I think has graded out as like a 92nd, 95th percentile rim runner for multiple seasons in a row headed into, you know, before his injury. And so that's valuable to have. It definitely will help Luka in settings. Powell is still limited, very limited in a lot of ways. You know, he's not going to play 30 minutes in a playoff game. I would not, you know, wager in any means. And if he is, like we were saying, that's a problem. Like that means things have gone poorly. So it's good. It's good. You know, I think that everybody, you know, just from a human level, it's fantastic to see him have games like that because Achilles injuries suck. They're just shitty injuries and they're very hard to come back from. And I am, you know, I'm happy for him. He is someone I've described as a embodiment of the Dirk Nowitzki culture and ethic and what this team tries to be. He is someone who is always working and grinding. And I do think that they truly value him as a person around their organization who represents those values. And the fact that, you know, he finally looks like a functional player who is close to what he was. Maybe he won't be as a consistent, you know, certainly I think in some ways that, you know, he's probably never going to get back to 100% of the player he was. But, you know, if he's approaching 90, 95%, if he's approaching 85%, I think that there's value to have that on the roster. And I think that could be a important chip or important card that Carlisle, who is a, you know, plays, you know, does very much view playoff series as a poker game or as some other, you know, just high level strategic back and forth maneuvering with an opposing coach. That's a good thing for Carlisle to be able to use and for Luka, you know, to have that outlet, literally that outlet, you know, cutting to the rim. So those are all good things. Do they change how I feel about the Mavericks in the macro sense? No, you know, again, nothing at this point will. But it's good. It's good. And I think it's worth noting that we should be very happy that, you know, happy for Powell and happy that he was able to have those games and show that he's already to you know, already this quickly, just like 14 months after his injury and his surgery, looking like the player he is.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You know who played against Sacramento? Josh Green. He got a few minutes, and me and Mike Pelucci. Mike, you have some bones to pick?
I mean, I feel like the ongoing narrative about Josh Green. And I should know for the record, I was a Josh Green guy on draft night. That was the dude who I thought made the most sense for them out of that cluster of wings. I thought they were graded fairly similarly, right? But I feel like the longer the season has gone, there's a certain, particularly because Sadiq Bey and Desmond Bane have played as well as they have, there has been a conversation which goes something like this. They have played well, therefore Josh Green is a bust. They have done well, therefore the Mavericks screwed up by taking Josh Green. And it is driving me insane because for a variety of reasons, right? But we'll start, I mean, literally, I could list them and number them. But the first place to start with this is, I can't overstate this enough, Des Bane was a four-year college player who turns 23 in a couple months. Sadiq Bey is a two-year guy who is an older two-year guy. He turned 22 already. He played at Role Player U, as I believe Dave Dufour has been fond of saying. Josh Green was a one-year college guy in a situation in Arizona that has kind of gone off the rails the last couple of years. The minute you take Josh Green and not those two guys, you are accepting that this is going to be a longer learning curve. And that's especially true at a year where there is no summer league. There is no real camp. You just kind of get thrown into this mix. So it's starting to drive me a little crazy when I'm hearing this and it's like, oh, the decision's already, you know, it's already been written that Josh Green has automatically failed. Nobody I feel like the start of the year was necessarily expecting Josh Green to play well. It is just now because Des Bane and Sadiq Bey have played and contributed, and it should be noted, worse situations than what Dallas is right now. That is starting to reflect on the Josh Green pick, when in reality, it's kind of like, if you are judging this, you know, 4 months into the weirdest season ever of a one and done college kid who we knew was raw, I don't know what to tell you. And I hate to be that guy who says, give it time, but like, you need to give it 2 or 3 years, especially, you know.
Sounds like you don't hate to be that guy.
It's the draft though, right? Like every single draft pick, you can't judge it that season. Now, I will say I am in that chorus that thinks Desmond Bane or Sadiq Bey would have been better picks because of the position that you're in with Luka Doncic. You had the two draft picks that were kind of in the same area. So you could have taken a swing on a guy and also taken a safe guy. I like the draft. I just don't think that good teams necessarily should be drafting for a high ceiling. If you want to try to be like a playoff contender this year, you could have gone with one of those guys that are ready to be NBA rotation role players. Now, look, draft capital being what it is, I totally understand that game. I just personally would like to see teams draft players that you know are ready to play today, especially if you're not a lottery team. I mean, this is a team that was hoping to win a playoff series this year, and I just think that Sadiq Bey and Desmond Bane help you now and the next 3 years. I don't know if Josh Green helps you at any point in the next 3 years.
Well, the obvious thing here is that if the Mavericks had a full functioning rotation, if they had veterans above Green that were ready to step in and play, this would not.
Then
be
you good. Can do it, and it doesn't matter.
Right. And so that was a lot, the plan. I think.
Then you're Denver. Then you're Denver, and you have RJ Hampton, who looks awesome,
right,
but he never plays because he's a project.
So my point is that Josh Green has been victimized by the Mavericks' lack of team building and the lack of bringing in more depth. And because he is the player that, you know, when the team is struggling, when they clearly need some sort of player off the bench to come in and make an impact, when they clearly are light on perimeter defense, when they need another wing out there, the fact that Josh Green isn't ready is used against him. It's, you know, that's unfair. That is not Josh Green's fault, but I understand how some of the criticism of him is really a criticism of the front office, is really a criticism of this team not really, I mean, we've said it, it's just not changing in a couple of years. So I think it's an indictment in that way. You know, as for Josh himself, you know, I've seen signs of him understanding basketball to a good level. You know, I think he makes smart passes, and I think a player who makes smart passes, I think that's a good sign. I think that is a really good positive encouragement that, you know, if you have that feel for the game, then, you know, the other stuff that takes a little bit longer to develop, jump shooting, the Mavericks have proven they can develop bad jump shooters into mediocre ones, into average ones. You know, we've seen that with Dorian Finney-Smith. I absolutely think that's something that is possible with Josh Green. I am slightly down on his defense just because he's not really a tall guy. He's not a wing like he is, but
neither of the other two.
He's 6'5".
He's measured at 6'5" of the combine, right? Des Bane is 6'5". If, you know, Sadiq Bey is a
but
little
Des Bane
longer.
Has really short arms.
So, yeah, I mean, so we're not drafting Des Bane necessarily to sit there and say he's a defensive answer, too. I mean, right. I think Dave's point.
Sure, but Des Bane is the much better shooter, and that's the
thing. He is. Yeah. I mean, here's where I come from, right? And I understand. I think, to me, this is two ways to value the draft, and I don't think either are, you know, is necessarily wrong. Because I think where Dave is coming from about, hey, this team is good, take a guaranteed role player, just get somebody who can help you, I totally get that. My thought process with why I like Green was, in the bigger picture, if this team is going to be contending, is Sadiq Bey or Des Bane really big picture when you are trying to win a title? They're rotation guys, right? Are we sitting there saying that they're monster ceiling raisers? I don't think Josh Green is either, but what I do think Josh Green is, he's a better athlete than either guy. And if Josh Green develops defensively, you can use him in a way you can't use one of the other two. And that's especially relevant given what we just talked about. This team can't guard anybody on the perimeter. They're looking at a guy, Josh Green, and they're saying, you know what, if he develops offensively, and we know that he shows those instincts, he has that stuff that was scouted about him, he has some physicality, the ceiling of that skill for what this team needs long-term, if you could pair a jump shot with that, because you know he can go down the court and run the break, right? I mean, the guy can throw down in transition. Luka can make that work. I see from their perspective saying, hey, this is the best pick we might get in a few years. Why not take a swing on a guy who, if this breaks right, as a perimeter defender, can raise the ceiling a bit? Now, if there is a criticism of that strategy, and this is where I think there would be a valid critique, it is you better develop him. And are you sure that this coaching staff will do that? Because if they can't, or if they don't show the patience to get him minutes, and there have been times where they could have played him when guys are sitting out, or it's garbage time, or it's late in the game, they could throw him out there for more minutes than they have. If you don't think that this coaching staff can or is showing the priority to develop him, then yes, that is a failure of this front office or the coaching staff or some larger form of organizational communication, because one side has in their head, let's take the ceiling guy, and the other side isn't doing the legwork to make that work. In which case, yes, you should take the safer thing. But if everybody's on the same page, and from the outside, we kind of have to just hope that they are, because it's not like any of us really know. You sort of have to assume that they might be. I see the logic of, hey, let's take the higher ceiling guy defensively, because we've seen around the league, yes, these are different body type guys, but DeAndre Hunter was nothing last year. And look at DeAndre Hunter now. Mikal Bridges took a giant leap in year three. Hell, Dorian Finney-Smith is a dude who's gradually taken steps over time. Even the guys who are defensive-oriented prospects can develop at a slower pace. So I get the logic. I just think it's a little, you know, I think Tim's right that people are blaming, putting organizational failures on this 19-year-old, or sorry, 20-year-old now rookie, which is a little unfair. But my position is just, hey, it was always going to be a longer track record, or longer learning curve, a longer track of development with this guy. Just because two other dudes in worse situations are playing better doesn't necessarily mean this is a failure, especially if you knew all along this was going to have to be a longer game pick.
He's definitely going to be a good defender. Because once you make the pick, I do not think that he has the heights of his ceiling are not as high to warrant his selection over those two players who have already proven themselves offensively and are, you know, solid defenders. Even, you know, yeah, I think Green does have a higher defensive ceiling. I just think that the most valuable wing 3-and-D defenders are guys that ultimately are going to be able to switch onto big men. And I don't think he's ever going to be able to do that consistently or well. And
I don't think any of the specifically, other three were, but yeah.
No, and I'm not saying that those other two were able to do that either, but they already have proven a offensive acumen that I'm not sure that Josh Green is going to reach. You know, I think at best that Josh Green, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know. I think they're already both better shooters than him, and I don't ever see that level of shooting from Josh Green. Now, you do have more flexibility because Luka is 6'8". He's a guard. He's your, you know, primary creator. You're not pairing Josh Green with, you know, Kemba Walker and saying, all right, well, we have a 6'1 and a 6'5 player. You know, we really need to have the rest of the players, you know, at more switchable. You have some more flexibility where you could get a guard on the floor and you get Josh Green on the floor and you get Luka on the floor. And, you know, that can be your 1-2-3 on a important line, you know, starting lineup for against a playoff team, or, you know, just any lineup. But I just think that the defensive skill specifically that is so valuable at this point in the NBA, at this point with the way modern offenses work and the way you have to defend them, is a player that is able to switch on to 6'8", 6'10 players, onto big men, onto, you know, ball carrying, you know, ball handling wings. And I just worry, you know, maybe I'm proven wrong. Maybe he's a Marcus Smart type who just plays way above his size. I'm just a little worried that I'm not sure he's going to do that. And because he's not able to do that, and because he doesn't have that specific type of defensive upside, even though he should be, I think, a very good defender. I just worry that, you know, the upside wasn't actually there when you kind of look at the other two players and what they've been able to do.
Again, I don't know if he's a bust or not, because we haven't even finished his first season. Yeah. So
we're definitely not saying that. I do want to make that clear. I don't think
I've seen it in discourse. And it's kind of it's getting out there. I mean, I do think the height thing.
People are doing it about a James Wiseman. You know, I think that's just what people do.
Once again, this is we're talking with a high degree of nuance. This is about, in retrospect, would it have made more sense to take one of the other two players?
I mean, you know how I felt. I
would have taken,
like,
Desmond
Tim
Bain.
Got tired of me saying it. So,
and honestly, it looks like all three of us were wrong, and Sadiq Bey might have actually been the best selection of those three.
I don't know. Bey was my guy.
Wanted Sadiq Bey the whole time, and mm-hmm. is trying to take his victory lap now. Yeah, I mean, I do think like there is another way. If he can't guard bigs, he can't switch onto bigs, but he could switch onto ones, because clearly they try to do that with Dorian Finney-Smith. I mean, look, it's not like anywhere on this team is defensively sound right now, but you could absolutely add pick and roll ball handlers high up on the list of things they need to find a solution for. I'm not saying Josh Green can be that guy, but that is another avenue of, if you can't switch him onto bigs, but you could have him spend time on pick and roll ball handlers, that would work for this team in a big way too. I think there are a lot of ways he could tap into defensive value. We just have to see how the offensive game develops.
Yeah.
Do you think that he plays more than, let's say, 20 minutes in a playoff game in the next two seasons?
No.
I'm going to say no. I think it's a three-year learning curve. And if that's my answer, then like I totally get if your perspective is that this was not the right pick because they can't wait 3 years of Doncic era. That's a valuable argument to make, and I get it. I also, though, at the same time, it's kind of like, all right, even if you had Desmond Bane, is that really going to raise your ceiling that much? Like if you're depending on either one of them to meaningfully change your fortunes right now, I mean, I know you're looking at me like that.
So would Desmond Bane start? Would Sadiq Bey start? I think that there's a high likelihood that one of those guys would have at least started double digits this year.
They would do with more this year. But big picture, I mean, 3 years down the road when it's put up or shut up time, what are they really going to be doing? I don't know. I mean, I saw this team with a fantastic shooter who didn't add a lot of defensive value in last year's playoffs. His name is Seth Curry. He had one great game against the Clippers and couldn't stay on the floor otherwise in a meaningful capacity. So I don't know. Like, and granted, I mean, Dez is a better defender, could hold his own. He's not an impact defender, but he's not going to be a liability. But like, I don't know. If by year three we're not seeing with Green, then I think it's clearly a problem. But for me, I think if it's going to happen, it's going to take a couple of years. And at that point, in 2 years' time, not this year, not next year, down the road, he's 22 that postseason. He's still pretty damn young at that point. If it works at that timeline, that to me is not a failure. If at age 22, Josh Green is the player you thought he'd be. Because then he is at age 22. Sadiq Bey is 22 right now. Dez Bane's gonna be 23 in June. Okay. So let's see what happens.
I think we've topped out on Josh Green talk.
I think
the Josh Green discourse is out of control.
Wild.
It's too high.
Wild.
There's too much of it.
Need more Tom Green discourse.
That's what he knows who that is. Gerald Green.
Tim, Tim, as the young one of this podcast, do you know who Tom Green is? What's your Tom Green knowledge, Tim? Because Dave and I know who Tom Green is.
As far as I know, does not exist.
Much like other Mavericks podcasts don't exist?
I don't think that a person named Tom Green has ever existed. That just seems salacious, false. Like, you're trying to pull one on
me. You know that thing that everyone does now on the internet where they try to be funny with the, like, videos and everyone wants to be famous? Tom Green might have been the first guy to actually kind of pull that stuff off.
Okay. I mean, he was really the forebearer in a lot of ways to, like, I mean, a little like,
oh, that's Jackass, a whole other podcast. Like,
it is. Yeah.
We're talking about how real world ruined the world. Oh,
Tom Green is the TikTok founder is what I'm taking away from this. And I will, I'll take that to my grave. All right. We're wrapping up basketball talk. We just wanted to talk briefly.
Before we go, we want to send some love to friend of the pod, friend of all three of us, friend of a lot of Mavs fans, the great Jonathan Jarks over at The Ringer. He was diagnosed with cancer, as he announced on Twitter the other day. John covers the NBA at large, but he is a Dallas guy. He is somebody who, if you follow the Mavs, you know that John is really a Mavs fan. Just an awesome dude. You know, I mean, media is a small world, especially when you're in a certain city or a certain region, you know a lot of people. John is someone who we all know, we've all been friends with, because he's not just a talented guy, he's a good friend. He's somebody who cares about the people around him. He's the epitome of a family guy. He has a wife and a one-year-old son. We're all pulling for him. We're thinking of you, buddy. And we look forward to talking some hoops with you soon. Because I know, you know, even as he's fighting this thing, he's going to be watching plenty of basketball like always. Is he be thinking the same usual smart Jonathan Jarks Mavs thoughts and basketball thoughts?
Well, yeah, he's got to get those takes off.
Absolutely.
That's what we need.
Yeah, I've known him through SB Nation and back at Mavs Moneyball. He was full-time writing for SB Nation, but, you know, still was such a Mavs guy that every once in a while he would just you know, just had a had an article, had a column he needed to get out there. And, you know, you, they're so good. We were just like, yeah, dude, whenever, literally whenever, you know,
yeah.
Pop in our email and, you know, and he would, he'd always have players that he was just insanely high on. And sometimes he was like so perfectly right. And he'll admit that sometimes he was very off. I think huge KJ McDaniels fan. if I'm remembering right. And so, yeah, we've, yeah, I've known Charles going back a while. And so, you know, right now he doesn't, he's not asking for anything except some thoughts and some prayers if that's something that, that you feel inclined to do and send his way. But yeah, we just wanted to acknowledge that and say that certainly we're thinking of him and that we're rooting for him and all that stuff. So with that, we'll see you guys next week with some more Mavericks discussions. Probably no Josh Green, or Tom Green, but we'll see you guys then.
Don't fight the future. Please be nice to Luca. Future 4-time in.